This year's theme for International Women's Day on the 8th of March calls for us to break the bias. And so on this latest Agenda podcast episode brought to you by Auxerra, we'll be celebrating the role of women in economics and exploring how economics can help to break the biases that women face at home, in the workplace, and through wider social constructs. Hi, and welcome to this Women in Economics episode of the Agenda podcast. My name is Russell Goldsmith. I'm thrilled to be joined online by, firstly, from Washington, D.C., Antara Dutta, a in-house economist at Amazon. Plus, we also have two of Auxerra's own economists, Principal Katie Lee English, who is based in the UK and specialises in public policy and transport, and then Lola Damstra, a consultant who specialises in competition and behavioural economics and joins us from the Netherlands. So welcome to you all. We're here today to talk about what bias means, how can economics inform and help, and also how data can enforce biases. So Lola, I thought we could start by you maybe just explaining exactly what is a bias.
Yes, indeed. It is very important to start by explaining what a bias is, because it has quite a negative connotation. And in reality, a bias is just a mental shortcut, and these are very important to us humans because we actually have limited brain power, and to get through the day we cannot think intensively about every single decision we need to make, and we need to make millions a day. So mental shortcut is in principle a very useful tool that we apply when we have encountered a situation before, or from experience, or what we heard around us, and we apply this on a daily basis. We apply it, for example, when we think about what to have for breakfast. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can lead to errors because the shortcut is not always right. And it may mean that you try to make a decision quickly that if you had taken a little bit more time to think and evaluate, you would have reached a better outcome.
Antara, what's your thoughts on this?
So I agree with what Lola just said as a descriptive kind of summary of what bias means. It's often called unconscious or implicit bias for the exact same reason as Lola described, which is we're not necessarily engaging in bias in an active or deliberate or intentional way. Sometimes that happens too, but what we're talking about for the most part here is just the unconscious element of it, or the part where the bias takes over the brain because we're unable to actually deal with every single fact and situation in a very specific, deliberate way. And so I do think it's very important when we talk about this kind of bias to normalize it, right? Because when people hear bias, they hear all kinds of connotations around it. And while we obviously want to break the bias, fight the bias, we must first talk about the bias and normalize the bias, right? And what do I mean by that? I mean that we all have this bias, as Lola just explained, and it is not an attack on any one individual to say that they have bias. So we are here talking about breaking the bias, and each of us have our own biases. And so we all come to the table accepting that we have biases too. In terms of how can this bias actually affect, say, women in the workplace, just sort of we'll be talking more about it in detail, but just a few examples. So if you look at a profession like economics, which is dominated by men, and you have organizations which are led by men or dominated by men, what can happen when you have this kind of bias, unconscious, implicit, unintentional, etc., is that when a young woman, say, comes into an organization, she may not end up receiving the adequate amount of mentorship or guidance or investment in her. She may not benefit from what I call sort of informal elements of the job. So the informal coaching, the networking, the chit-chat opportunities that might occur for men with their superiors and colleagues. It may not happen as organically. You may not be kept in the loop when it comes to everyday developments on a project. Again, not because anyone's trying to kick you out of the loop, but because they're not knocking on your door. They may not be picking up the phone to call you. They may not invite you for the coffee or the lunch. And so I think it is really important to note that this isn't deliberate exclusion, or a lot of it is not deliberate exclusion, but it does happen, and it can happen over time and adds up and can lead to lots of negative consequences for women unless we're conscious of it. So I think the most effective way to combat this unconscious bias is to become conscious of it and check ourselves, you know, stop and think and normalize and keep talking about it.
Katie, you were nodding along quite a bit there. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I completely agree. A self-reflectivity seems to be the key. We can't get rid of the bias. It's there for a reason. It's there for good reason, as Lola said. But what we can do is be more aware of when our decisions are being influenced by bias and check ourselves if those aren't good decisions. I was also interested in what Antara was saying there about women being in a minority or in professions where women are a minority. What you see there is also the fact that when you then come across another woman, you have this big thing in common. And one of the biases that I see a lot is the bias where you think everyone else is like yourself. And particularly when you've got two females in a male-dominated environment, you think you're the same. And a bias creeps in when you're making that assumption, and therefore you assume that the approaches to success that you have might be the same for other people. And that isn't always the case.
It's interesting that Katie made the point about how we think everyone's the same. That certainly happens and can lead to bias. Another kind of bias in lines with what Lola was talking about is when your brain is categorizing information in ways to keep yourself sane. Say you're a man and your primary experience with women has not been to encounter them in the workforce, right? Then on the one hand, you might sometimes behave like everybody's the same and not make the distinctions when they're necessary. At other times, you may be putting women in a different bucket because you're not used to thinking of women as professionals. You're thinking of them as caretakers or something else. And you might be putting them in a bucket when in fact you should be treating them equally. So both things can be at play, I think, and things to be conscious of.
Katie, I'd be keen to get your thoughts on this in terms of what biases women face in the workforce and how can we challenge and improve it?
So I'll start with a couple of anecdotes. So one goes back to when I was much younger and our school offered a work experience place at air traffic control. And I was one of two people that really wanted that work experience. I, at the time, aspired to be a pilot. Obviously, I didn't become a pilot, but I really wanted that place. But there was another person, and it was a male who wanted that place. And the careers advisor said, it's a man's job, so I'm going to offer it to the guy. And that was the first time, and it's obviously stuck with me, that I really saw the impact of bias in that case, the very early days of workplace. Now, in that instance, I did actually get that placement, and it was because the guy couldn't get to and from the airfield. And so it's just to highlight, it's not just about biases that can hold women or men back. There's socioeconomic factors and other things aside from capabilities and aspirations that can cause problems. So that was one example. The second example is more recent, and it relates to a conference where I was the lead speaker, and I went to grab a cup of tea before it started, and the waitress was away filling the coffee pot, and the gentleman came up to me and said, excuse me, can I have a cup of tea, please? And I just said, yeah, help yourself. But it was just an example of where somebody has looked at this situation and thought, oh, young female, a conference on the rail sector dominated by men, probably the waitress. So again, not a great example of how women are generally perceived. But then again, that example is 8 years ago. And if that is the most recent example I can think of where it was overt, maybe that's a positive sign. So how do we improve it? Firstly, as I say, we've got to recognise it's not going away. These biases are built in. But what we do have to do is start recognising when it's influencing our decisions. So being more self-reflective and aware of where it's having negative impacts on our decisions. But we also need structures, institutions, regulations that help limit the impact of these biases. So gender pay gap reporting is such a great example, because for people that deny that there is an issue, there is some hard evidence that suggests there are biases most likely influencing decisions in the workplace. So being aware and instituting these procedures and regulations that can really help us understand what is going on, I think, is important.
It's interesting listening to those couple of stories. Lola, do you think women themselves can be afraid to break the bias that they may have experienced?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important thing to remember, is that these biases don't just apply to men, right? They apply to everyone, and Katie already alluded to that. But a lot of these biases are a bias against the self, is this belief of what you are supposed to be, what you are expected to be as a woman in terms of the character traits that society expects of you. The standard ones are to be cooperative and nurturing and amicable. And I think this is the struggle that many women face, is that on the one hand, they want to show their competence and capabilities, and at the same time not be too aggressive or dominant or competitive. And this is the constant struggle that women face, not only because of the bias that men may have, but the bias that women may have against themselves. And I think this is something that comes from a very young age, where you may hear or read about what is expected of you as a young girl, to be kind, to be kind of demure and polite. And these are things that are taught much less to young boys. And I think it's from a very young age that you start to believe what your career might look like, what your life might look like. And this can be very limiting once you enter the workforce, about this belief of how much you may speak up and how loud you may be and how much you may show your confidence in yourself and toot your own horn. So I definitely think that this bias of the self and this fear of breaking the bias is a real concern here.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Lola made this particular point around sort of the expectations around women having to be demure. And of course, they're reinforced not just in explicit ways, but by images we see in movies, by who we decide to cast as the lead in a movie or in a story, who saves the day at the end. Often it's the man in the cape, you know. And so all of these things are, you know, sit in our brains, and we're constantly putting women and men and others in categories that are reinforced by these images. I mean, I do have a very direct example of exactly what Lola said, which was at some point in my career, I'd had a very challenging and very, you know, thrilling in some ways, but challenging and busy year, where I had had a whole bunch of new responsibilities thrust upon me that I wasn't expecting. And I came out of it somewhat unscathed and kind of enjoying this new role. I had a performance review at the end of the year where overwhelmingly the review was positive, which I appreciate. But there was a line in there talking about how Antara, she's great and all that, but she's too direct and is not emotionally nurturing enough of her team. Which, those two things, being criticized for being too direct and not being emotionally nurturing enough, it is very hard for me, with everything I know about the world, to think that a man would ever get a review like that. And so, again, reinforces ideas in my head about how I'm supposed to be. That's the kind of danger of resorting to it.
You and Katie here as well, you both have young children. I was just wondering what biases you think women face in relation to family and caring commitments within the workplace as well.
I mean, there's a lot of issues around women and family and childcare and all of that, some of which we were touching on. And I'll just raise two quick points. We'll not be able to do justice to all of it. But one thing is that I personally experienced, and I know others have, is if you are a woman who is pregnant in the workforce, okay, and you're in a workforce which is very fast-paced, and you're in this stage in your life where you're just about to enter, like, just a physically, emotionally, mentally demanding phase that's very different than what most other people in your office are going through at the time. And say you're working like everybody else, and then all of a sudden there starts to feel like a vacuum, where people are taking you off cases for all the right reasons, because you're about to go on leave. You have the baby, you're at home with the baby, you're completely disconnected from the workforce. The profession obviously goes on. And then you come back, and it really feels in some ways like you're starting certain things from scratch, right? That period is a very, very emotionally and professionally vulnerable period for a woman. And it's very, very important that we recognize that and support it, and don't treat it as if it's sort of a scary thing that no one should talk about, but take it head on, normalize that, understand that it's difficult without necessarily making the woman feel like she did something wrong by just taking time off to have a baby, right? And you would think these issues belong in the 1950s or 60s, but I can tell you, like, when I had my first child in my job at the time, I was actually denied a pretty significant work opportunity. And I was told that one of the reasons was because I was gone while everyone else was working 300 hours a month, okay? And when I heard those words, that I was gone while everybody else was working, it made me feel like I had been told I was kind of sitting on a beach drinking cocktails on the firm's time and dime while everyone else was working, when in fact I was doing something that's just one of the most fundamental things of civilization, right? Which is giving birth to part of the next generation, which is people have been doing it for centuries. And so understanding that that can really hurt women and hold them back, and being really deliberate about that process is very important. The second thing quickly I'll say is the composition of workforces or offices or teams can be quite different when you're considering sort of working women's situations versus working men's situations. And when you have a working parent who is a man, in many instances, they might have a spouse, not always, but in many instances, they might have a spouse that may not be working full-time outside the house, which in my case, I've seen that happen many times. But most women I know, just as an empirical matter, when they have a child, they tend to have, they're much more likely to have a working spouse. So when you're thinking about how they're dividing their time between childcare and at home and responsibilities at work, they're facing a very different situation than the man in question, right? And this is not a judgment. No one's saying, you know, your life is not as complicated as mine. It's just that it's different. And we saw this during the pandemic, especially when there were no boundaries left between the home and work. And it affected women and men who had fellow working co-parents very differently than others who had a different situation at home. And so I think we should be conscious of that, not defensive about it, and be able to recognize that these are, we face very different situations. So those would be two things I would mention in this category.
Yeah, both great points, and particularly the first one about you being out. One of my bugbears is the fact that we call work paid work when actually there is a lot of work that's going on that's unpaid, but because it's unpaid, it's not described as work. One thing that I realise, particularly being on maternity leave and talking to a lot of other mums, is you see the first question when you meet somebody, or in that first conversation, the question comes up, what do you do? And if you are not in paid work at that time, it's really difficult to answer that question. And quite often the answer is used as a factor that correlates with your worth in some way. So if we're talking about biases, the shortcut we use, we say, what do you do? And the answer, if it's not a career, is really hard question to respond to, because people use it as a mental shortcut to see how clever are you, how hardworking are you, how successful are you. That was just a reflection on your first point. In response to your question, Russell, about how it kind of affects working women who have children, it's very fashionable these days to say women can have it all. You can have the high-flying career and you can have the wonderful family life. And I certainly hope that is true. But economics is all about scarcity and choice. And the ultimate scarce resource is time. Like, time's limited. And so you have to make a choice between how you're going to spend your time. It's not just for parents, it's for all of us. How do we spend our time? And as much as we want to be as efficient as possible in anything we do, ultimately, when you've got children, there is a choice to make. Is it an hour on work or is it an hour on childcare? Because there is an element of a zero-sum game. One goes up, one goes down. So there's recognising that, I think, is important. And then the other bias that I think is relevant here is one I mentioned earlier about assuming that everyone's like ourselves. We often think when we're talking about biases against women that we're looking to men. What do men think about us and how are their biases influencing us? But actually, because we often assume people like ourselves, if you've got people that are similar in situations, so take working women with young children, it's very easy to assume that if you found a solution to this, that that's the solution for everybody else. And you talk to people and you think, oh, I can just tell them how I did it and that's the answer. But you know, the right solution to the balance of work and childcare will depend on personal preferences, personal circumstances. So it's just another one to be aware of, and one that crops up a lot, particularly in family situation.
And I think another important point to make here is that we can also not break this bias without considering the bias that there is on men, the bias that men face in parenthood and their ability to take time to be a parent, and how that is reacted to within the workplace, and how hard it is for men to take time off work to be a dad. And I think as long as there is a bias on men, it will be very hard to have an even balance of men and women taking care of the children. And the same way that there is a bias that women are better at nurturing and at caring and at taking care of the children, there is this bias that men are better suited to be a leader or to do manual labor or whatnot, but certainly not to be at home and take care of the children. And unless we can break that bias as well and have it normalized that men want to spend time with their children, want to be there when their baby is born, and beyond that as well, to spend time with children and be a dad, it won't be possible to have an even sharing, even division of labor, of caring commitments.
Completely agree. It's such an important point.
Can economics demonstrate or evidence, you know, these biases that you're talking about in women and men's personal lives, and particularly on this caring responsibility aspect?
I think, for example, a lot of the time, biases are justified by the current structure. We say, oh, yes, women are less committed to work, they are less ambitious. Look at them, half of them are staying at home mums, or they work part-time. And in reality, there is little choice, right? It is not necessarily a choice of men and women to have the division of labor like that. It is because of the norms that are being put on us, because of the cost of childcare. And I think you can see, and compare in European countries where the cost of childcare is a lot lower, you see much more participation of women in the labor force. And I think there are plenty of ways that economics can help uncover this by implementing certain policies, putting structures in place that allows men and women to have a freer choice in how they want the division of labor to be. Think about parental leave being divided equally amongst men and women. And then still you will see that doesn't solve the entire problem, because there is still the belief of what you are expected to do, right? Even if the correct structures are in place, if I still hold the belief that I should be taking care of my children and seeing them every evening, it will still be hard to pursue a full-time career. But I think at least when you have the structures in place, there is at least the possibility to take those on.
And I think that in terms of what you just said, Lola, about how hard it is for men sometimes to be supported by society to do the things that are typically attributed as being women's roles, you're absolutely right, because we all know of cases, I'm sure I know of many, where there are firms that have actually, maybe with the best of intentions, maybe as a marketing tool, have promised both men and women, say, the same amount of parental leave. And yet when a man takes it, sometimes it's viewed as a sign that he's not committed to his career and he's on his way out. It's almost like I have a baby and I take that leave and I'm signaling to the firm that I'm not interested in getting to the highest ranks. And that same man, when he's presented with these choices, if he chooses then not to take the leave and stay at the firm, becomes the dad that many of us have encountered, who jokes about at company happy hours, will joke about how terrible it was that he had to babysit his kids over the weekend. So it's all part of how all these things reinforce each other. But I do agree that it's important to first get the structure right, which is to give men the leave, but then also encourage them to take it and not penalize them for that.
Just to add, when I used to say I was babysitting, friends reminded me, or work colleagues reminded me, it's not babysitting, it's parenting, Russ.
Exactly.
So just something to consider.
Thank you for sharing that.
Lola, I mentioned at the top of the show the theme of International Women's Day is Break the Bias. We've kind of touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to dig, you know, a little deeper in terms of how economics can inform and help achieve that.
Yeah, I think that economics can help actually at various stages of this issue. I think in the first place, economics is a really important tool to understand what these biases are and if they're useful or not. Because in many cases, we believe certain things because of the structures that are in place, right? Like I gave the example of believing that women are not committed to work because you see a lot of women that are working part-time or stay-at-home mums. And I think economics is a really important tool to uncover what is indeed kind of innate biological differences, which biases are there for good reason, and which of them are actually just perpetuated by the structures that we see around us. And I think economics can really help uncover this.
And so there's obviously a lot of research carried out around this topic area. How would you say data enforces bias?
I will say, so I'll say at the outset that I might, as an economist, have a somewhat controversial view here, which is that I think data is really helpful and there's a role for data. But I think we as economists sometimes take on such a narrow version of what data means and we don't make the progress that we should be making. And what do I mean by that? So there is a lot of economic research, as Lola and you both mentioned, Russ, which is, you know, it shows all kinds of things like the effect of policies on women's participation in the labor force. But more recently and increasingly, you actually find a lot of research where women and men who are academic researchers in the economics profession are taking on bias in the profession very directly by looking at data on the profession, right? So on conduct, behavior, practices, policies in the profession. For instance, there's a paper out there that very painstakingly tracks sort of the types of questions that men and women receive during economic seminars. And they find that women are systematically subjected to more hostile questions than men, okay? And as economists who've been in seminars, I'm sure we've all experienced this, but if you think about the process that goes into actually collecting this data and doing the research and convincing people that your data was indeed correctly compiled, it's a huge endeavor. So it's not surprising that it's taken people a long time to do this, but also that it's still developing very much and there are a limited number of papers that actually look at these kinds of things because it's a really painstaking process. It's hard to collect the data. It's hard to go through the process of having it be accepted in the profession by your peers, et cetera. There's also similar research on publishing, showing that women might be held to higher standards than men in publishing. Again, a very, very painstaking, tedious process of collecting the data, which does wonders for making a point, but every point cannot possibly be made with this level of painstaking endeavor. And so that's where I think we must draw the line and accept that while some of these papers are extremely helpful, they're limited in context. They're primarily on sort of academic economists on academic practices. And we might, as practitioners, might have our own set of issues and challenges that are, you know, somewhat different. But also that not every single practice or every single act of bias can be assessed with huge amounts of data and regressions and such, right? And so if you look at the example I gave of the review I received where I was, you know, chided for not being emotionally nurturing enough and too direct, what would be sort of incumbent on me if I was trying to prove this with data? I would have to demand every single performance review that has ever come up in the firm, assign genders to the reviewer and the review person being reviewed, code up, the text and find out what words were used to describe whom, run some regressions, etc. I mean, it's an almost impossible task. And so instead, what we could be doing, instead of insisting, okay, where's the data and how do you know that this is bias, we could be trusting sort of anecdotes and experiences more and relating them to other forms of science, right? Whether it's sort of the behavioral sciences that, you know, Lola referred to, or looking at evidence of bias from other fields, looking at the vast amount of anecdotes and news stories and such in other fields, and saying that's all data too, even if it can't be put in a spreadsheet and, you know, you can't run regressions on it. So I think the data is important. I love the research. I'm glad it's being done, but I don't think we should let that limit ourselves when thinking about creative solutions to problems.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And the other point I wanted to make on data is that data reports what's happening at the moment, and biases arise because we extrapolate from the norm. So if the data is highlighting what the norm is and we're extrapolating from that, then it's not that helpful. That the data is telling us what's already there and we're trying to break that norm and say that maybe things can change. Data's about the past. So I don't think data has as big a role in this particular field as it might have elsewhere.
Yes, I was just going to say something about that, which I found really interesting in this book, Invisible Women, I don't know if you've heard of it, where it's being highlighted that a lot of the data is being collected by men. A lot of the research design is by men. And obviously, when you look at it from a male perspective, you may overlook many of the aspects that women can bring to the table. And I think, for example, when you think about GDP and unpaid work not making it to the GDP measurement, I think for a really big part that will have to do with men having decided what GDP looks like. And I'm sure that if 100 women were around the table and had to decide how you calculate GDP, probably they would include unpaid work because they know how important it is and what it means for society. And so I think the biases can really be enforced by data when the people in charge of the data and the research are biased.
No, that's a really important point. Lola, let's come to you first on this final question, but I want to ask each of you this. What do you think the most important thing is that we can all do to break the bias?
Yeah, I don't think I have an economic solution to this, but I think it's much more of a cultural solution. And from a personal perspective and upbringing, I think it would be very important to start telling children about this, having books with female heroes, but also movies starring female leaders, having statues raised of important women in economics, in politics, in art. Just cultural beliefs are perpetuated when the world around us seem to confirm them. And I think by breaking the bias, we need to have representation, and we need to have women on coins, we need to have women on dollar bills, and we need to have representation in our study books. We need to have female doctors in our education books.
I saw a video done, it was a couple of years ago. It's a video campaign. It's all around breaking the bias of various different professions. And it's interesting you're talking about that, because certain gender stereotypes, according to this campaign, are created at such a young age. And this particular campaign, they asked loads of children, very young children, to draw a firefighter, a pilot, a doctor. And then they asked them to name the people that they'd drawn in them. And the vast majority had given them a male name. And then they brought three people in. So they had a firefighter, but with the helmet on, and a pilot with a helmet on, and a doctor, and then or a surgeon. And then when they all took their masks off, all three were women. And, there was like this stunned silence in the classroom. And it's interesting that gender stereotype is created at such a young age. I was just wondering what you thought of that, Lola, based on what you were just saying there.
Yeah, I think this is really where it begins. This is where it starts. This is where young women and men alike are starting to see what their life looks like and what their career might look like. And this is why girls at the age of 15, when they need to decide the field that they go into, they think that STEM subjects are not for them, they're for men. Economics is for men. And it begins indeed at a very young age, and it gets perpetuated throughout their life. And it's too late when we start at the workplace. We need to start when they're young and learning about life.
You've got to start early on. If we don't tackle this from a really early age, then we've got no hope. But just a little anecdote to demonstrate what Lola's saying. I was reading to my four-year-old daughter, and it was a classic book. It was the first time I'd read it, and the tiger comes to tea, and he eats all the food and he drinks all the water. And the mum is up in arms about what they were going to do about daddy's dinner. And I got to the end of this book and I thought, oh my goodness, there's no food in the house. And the only concern is, how are we going to deal with daddy's dinner? So, I mean, it's interesting. I love the book, so I'm going to keep reading it, but I've changed the words because I can't read to her and tell her that the only thing she needs to worry about is how Danny's going to get his dinner when he gets home. But yeah, things like that, those really tiny things, if we don't fix all of those tiny signals that we send to our sons and daughters when they're younger, and it's as important, if not more important, to send those messages to sons, then we've got no hope. So yeah, just a reflection on Lola's point.
I mean, it's quite interesting seeing like films from years ago now and how dated and how cringy sometimes they can be when you're watching them in all this stereotyping. Ansara, let's give the final word to you.
Okay, so I'll follow up on this conversation on books and movies, because I do want to acknowledge and confess that I'm that crazy parent who constantly changes the words in books when I feel that it's biased. And so my kids at first were just protesting about how difficult it is to read a book with me, because I would stop, I would explain to them what the original words were and why I'm changing. Or I do this thing now with movies, especially the older movies, where I stop and I say, hey, did you notice that? I'm going to let you keep watching the movie. But by the way, this scene depicted women in this way or men in this way, and that's a bias. So my kids are watching movies or reading books with me are maybe not their most fun activity, but I like to think that it has, it will have some impact, and they'll appreciate it eventually. In terms of sort of what can we all do, Lola had the grand vision, which I love. I'll bring up the boring kind of practicalities of everyday life, where each of us may not be able to change what books are written or what movies are made. We can just be annoying like I am and pause and change the words and explain scenes. But we may not be able to actually have an impact on exactly what's written or produced. However, what we can do in our everyday life is just to acknowledge that we are all biased. Like bringing it back to what we started with and asking ourselves how that bias might manifest itself and how might it hurt someone some people, maybe benefits some people more than it benefits others. And it may be simple things. It may be about knocking on doors or virtual doors, however people do that these days. It may be about picking up the phone, or when you want to brainstorm with someone, try to look outside your immediate go-to circle or examine your immediate go-to circle and ask yourself if it's all people who are more like you. And could you expand that circle to bring more people in? It could be things like the words we use. You know, there's documentation that when we talk about women, we're often talking about women being, you know, I don't know, hardworking and caring and friendly and fun, while men are always smart and brilliant and leaders. Let's start talking about women as being smart and brilliant. Let's change it. Let's find one woman and refer to her as brilliant for a whole day. Let's make that a project. You know, let's change the way we talk. Let's change who we call upon. Let's change our small everyday practices, who we ask to have coffee with or lunch with, because that's all stuff that's in our power and we can do it. And so that's where I would beg all our great allies and, you know, both women and men to kind of stop, think, remember that the only way to check unconscious bias is to make yourselves conscious of it.
It's a great way to finish. Thanks to all of you for joining the show. So Antara Datta, Katie Lee English and Lola Damstra, thanks for joining me. Don't forget, Auxera would love to hear your thoughts on this topic. So if you'd like to contribute to the discussion, you can do that on their LinkedIn and Twitter posts where they have shared this podcast. If you've been inspired by what you've heard today and are interested in finding out more about working with the Auxera team, please do get in touch via the website too. And for more information on that, visit auxera.com/careers. We'd also love for you to subscribe or follow this podcast, which you can do on your favorite podcast app. And if you've enjoyed listening, please do give us a positive rating and review. And then finally, if you would like to get in touch with Auxera about agenda and any of the points raised here today or in any of our previous podcast episodes, you can do that by emailing agenda@auxera.com. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.